You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Later this hour, our guest tries to follow the money from a network of conservative donors led by the Koch brothers.
First, a lot of older Americans need reading glasses, but a new eye drop could eliminate the need for those pesky glasses. Our science expert, Gemma Tarlak, explains how these drops work and when they might be available.
She'll also talk about how gender affects epigenetics and the science behind earworms, those songs that get stuck in your head and just won't go away. Gemma Tarlak is senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the coolest headlines from the science world. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, thank you again for having me.
Well, let's start with these corrective eye drops that could take the place of reading glasses, I guess. How do they work?
Yeah, so this is really fascinating work, and it's actually pretty close to being out there on the shelf. Basically, as all of us age, the lens of our eyes stiffen. And this is important because if you're looking at the light rays from a nearby object, say closer than 30 feet, those light rays enter the eye at an angle, and the lens has to be supple enough to bend to take in the light rays correctly. And as we get older, the lens stiffens, can't quite take in those rays like it should be, so the image gets really blurry. The doctors combined two different drugs that are already out there, and they found a way to, this sounds worse than it is, trust me, they found a way to temporarily constrict the pupil of your eye. That sounds awful, but trust me, follow me on this. It creates this pinhole camera effect, and that makes the image super clear, but because it's essentially a pinhole effect, it also makes the image dark. So they created these eye drops where you put them in one eye, okay? I know that sounds crazy, but trust me, it works. You put them in one eye, so the eye with the eye drops sees the image clear but dark, and the eye without the eye drops sees the image bright but blurry, and mash them up together in your brain, and your brain actually sees the image as sharp and bright. So you don't need your reading glasses.
That's amazing. That sounds like
it's crazy.
Stuff of sci-fi to me, but you're saying these are eye drops that could be available in the nearish future?
Yeah, you know, they've done really successful trials with 48 people. Now, that's a small group, but the trials are very successful, so they're already looking into ways to ramp it up and, you know, find someone to sell these things.
And this is for people, now this is not for people who are wearing glasses for their daily use. This is for, hey, to read this book or a computer screen or whatever, I need
right.
reading glasses.
Yeah, exactly. This would replace reading glasses. If, you know, you have other issues with your eyes, sorry, so far you're on your own.
but maybe that's a next step? I mean, could there be some sort of, or is this being viewed as a, you know, one step toward a non-glasses correction and non-laser correction of eyes?
Well, this is really specific. It's addressing one really specific element of age-related eye issues, and that is the stiffening of the lens. Now, they may very well find related therapies that actually are good for other conditions, but right now it's pretty narrow, the condition they're trying to treat.
Obviously, these are not out there yet, and
no.
I have a lot of questions, though. So do you need to use these just in the morning? Is it good for all day, or would this be something you just put in right before you read, and then they're good for 15 minutes or something?
Well, they found that after they put the eye drops in, the pupils gradually, the effect wore off, basically, over time, over about 10 hours. So they're thinking it might be something you have to put in, like, once a day, each morning, maybe, and then just don't read at night, I guess. But it's, you know, about a 10-hour effect.
Well, let's switch gears now to a field that a lot of people are really excited about, this idea of epigenetics, where our genes determine some things, but they switch on and off. First of all, before we get to the new stuff, summarize epigenetics better than I just did.
Well, you know, we're all born with DNA, our own special blend of DNA. We got some from our mom, some from our dad, and we'll pass, you know, half of it on to our kids, essentially. We always thought for decades, your DNA is your DNA. You know, you're born with it, and unless you get in contact with some really awful chemicals that can change it, your DNA is your DNA. Now we're finding that's true to a point. There are all these chemical switches, some of them hormonally based, that if you have a specific gene, there's a chemical switch that can turn it on or off. And that's basically what epigenetics is, looking at those chemical switches and trying to understand how they can turn on and off. And what we're finding out is environment has a lot to do with the genes that get expressed. In other words, the genes get turned on, and the genes that don't get expressed, or the genes that get turned off by these chemical switches. And something that's really fascinating is a lot of your epigenetics, a lot of your chemical switches, come from your parents and specifically the experiences your parents had. And, you know, the author starts looking at research done about children of Holocaust survivors, because they found that children of Holocaust survivors, now these are children born after the Holocaust, they were not alive at all when it went on, but they were born afterward. They found that these children had very high rates of anxiety, exhibited like PTSD symptoms, had other real difficulties functioning, and they always assumed for decades that it was learned behavior, you know, that it was that they were picking up cues from their parents who had lived through this horrible trauma. But now they're finding actually epigenetically there is evidence that the trauma and the horrible experiences that the parents survived affected the chemical switches that turned on and off and actually left their children open to, you know, gene expression of things like anxiety or depression or other issues. And so it's not just that they were picking up cues from their parents, but they were actually their parents' DNA expression was changed chemically, epigenetically.
And Gemma, what do we know about what kind of practical application this could have for people later on?
Well, you know, obviously this is a very specific example, children of Holocaust survivors. But speaking more broadly, they're finding more and more evidence of things like this, that the parents' environment changed the chemical switches, and they passed those changes on to their children. So we're actually finding reasons how, you know, autism, schizophrenia, these are diseases that or disorders that affect people differently in terms of sex, you know. Males are much more likely to have autism, to have schizophrenia, whereas females are much more likely to have depression and other issues. And we're finding that there are a lot of clues that it's epigenetic switches. So this may lead to, well, first of all, better research, research that's more focused, and also, ideally, one day, better therapies and treatments.
And this is interesting because at one point I think we thought, okay, we map the genome and then we can puzzle everything out. We just look at your genes and we're going to know everything. This epigenetics thing is exciting, but it's way more complicated.
Oh, my gosh, it is so much more complicated because, you know, even if your parents had, you know, a great life and no awful experiences, you still, as a person, as an individual, you go through, say, puberty, you know, and, you know, if you're a woman, maybe you go through pregnancy, and those are hormonal storms that really also affect the epigenetic switches on and off in ways that we're just understanding. So it's fascinating work, and I think it's going to be hugely important, but we're still at the opening chapter of that book.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, getting the latest in science news. And Gemma, we're going to wrap up now with a topic everybody's had experience with, earworms. So, so we are sure we're talking about the same thing. What is an earworm?
An earworm. Oh my gosh. If your friends don't dance, then if they're no friends of mine, you know, it's that snippet of a song that gets stuck in your head and repeats and repeats and repeats and repeats and basically makes you crazy. And yeah, so it's a thing. It's not just like in your imagination. And there's research that finds out the more importance you put to music, like if you really love music and you're really passionate about it, and if you listen to it a lot, you are more likely to have more frequent and longer earworm infestations.
Infestations. Good word.
Yeah, so I've always been curious. I mean, I get these all the time. Sometimes it's a song I love. Often it is not. So why? What is it about our brains that just latch on and won't let go?
Well, first, I just have to say, don't worry, be happy.
Don't.
Well, they're finding, actually, people who get a lot of earworms, they have certain portions of their brain, like they have a thinner right frontal cortex, which is associated with inhibition. And other parts of the brain seem to indicate that these folks are just not as good at suppressing that song. And it also, again, if you listen to a lot of music, you're more likely to get them. A couple other factors. If you're worried or stressed or fatigued, you're more likely to get earworms, which scientifically, I think we all should know this term, involuntary musical imagery. That's what earworms technically are, scientifically speaking. Involuntary musical imagery.
Huh. Okay, so how do we get rid of them? Do we know anything about how to treat ourselves?
Yes. A couple quick tips. One of them is exposure. Sit down and listen to the entire song, even if it is Survivor's Eye of the Tiger. Just sit down and listen to it. And actually, the exposure kind of helps your brain kind of get off that record-skipping repeat loop. Also, distraction. There are a couple different ways of doing distraction. If you come up with a competing melody, for example, you know, if you have, I don't know, I don't even want to mention a bad song, but if you have a really terrible song stuck in your head, listen to another song, sing aloud another song, right, and kind of replace it. There's another form of distraction that's really new and hasn't been widely tested, but I'm going to try it, actually, the next time I get an earworm. And that is to sing the song out loud, to sing that earworm out loud, but as you do it, change it up. Change some of the words, change the melody a little bit, maybe, you know, move it into a minor key if you want. And that should do it. That should do the trick, and your brain should kind of get off that awful loop of repetition.
When I'm stuck on a song I don't like, I'll at least convert it into a ska version of the song or a heavy metal version in my head, and that is like, oh, it's actually kind of cool that way.
Yeah, that's actually one of the distraction forms to get rid of it.
I'm just worried about what you're going to be like in the office now. Now that Jenna's given you permission to sing all
out
these
loud,
songs.
And I'm a good singer.
All right, well, we're going to go out with producer Amanda Magnus's favorite earworm. Sorry, everybody. This is the safety dance.
Gemma, thanks as always.
Oh, I can dance if I want to.
All right. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time after a look at the latest news.
According to a number of legal experts, the suspect in a plot to attack a Milwaukee Masonic Center may never face terrorism charges.
Sammy Hamza was arrested by federal authorities last week for illegally possessing two machine guns and a silencer. According to the criminal complaint, he spoke about defending Islam and marching on the front of a war.
And while those statements seem to embody terrorism, this particular case falls into a legal gray area with regards to federal terrorism charges.
For the latest on the case, we're joined by Carrie Spivak, award-winning investigative journalist for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. How are you doing?
Good. Well, looking at this, this is something I think a lot of casual observers would say. This sounds a lot like, as described in the criminal complaint, a terrorist plot. But it sounds like you write, it's unlikely that the suspect would be charged with terrorism. Is that right?
That's correct. They'll charge them, but the terrorism statutes themselves, the federal terrorism statutes, are aimed more at the foreign terrorists than... This is, I guess, a gap in the law where he would likely not be charged with terrorism.
So some things, if he had done them differently, if the criminal complaint worked differently, would have led to terrorism charges. If he had planned, for example, to attack a federal building. So there are types of domestic terrorism that could be tried as terrorism, but he doesn't fall into any of those?
That's the way it appears now. From what we're seeing in the criminal complaint that was released, it still has to go to grand jury. But from what we've seen and what we've been hearing from sources, it doesn't sound like he hits the bars that you need to hit in order to be charged with federal terrorism.
So,
like you said, if it would have been a protected class or something along those lines, things could have been different.
So that's not to say he's not facing any charges. What specifically is he currently being charged with?
Oh, well, right now the criminal complaint has him on the 5 counts. Of possessing machine guns and the silencers. Each one goes up to a 10-year max. So, and then there could be some other things that they may be able to come up with. So, no, if they're able to prove their case, he does not walk away. I mean, it's interesting to note both the Oklahoma City bomber, McVeigh, and the Boston Marathon bombing were charged with all kinds of statutes, explosives, so on and so forth, murder. But they were not charged with violating the terrorism statutes.
Now, Oklahoma City, if I recall correctly, involved, I thought, a federal building. So that seems like that's a case where the terrorism charge could have applied. Or maybe that law wasn't in existence yet. I don't know.
I'm not sure if the law was in existence yet because they tightened up the terrorism statutes in order because they were seeing federal foreign terrorists falling through the cracks. It could have been a case where it's a simpler case by bringing it and ignoring it. It's not always a bad thing if they don't charge terrorism. As one of the people we quoted said, you know, if you charge terrorism, it kind of mucks things up for a jury, could make it more complicated. Plus, it gives the defendant the soapbox that he may have been seeking. Where if you charge him with more of a vanilla ice cream type charge, not that they're less serious, I don't want to imply that, but a different type of charge, he doesn't get the soapbox. All you have to do is prove he blew up the building, he purchased the machine guns or something along those lines.
And Carrie, in among the people you talked to for this story, was there any indication that you know, we should have the ability to charge, to have terrorist charges in this case? Does anybody feel like there's an absence or a gap here?
Surprisingly, we did not find anybody who said that. And there was a professor that we quoted early on who said that there was a gap, but they weren't saying, they said that it has to be addressed. But because there are other charges, they didn't see it as a huge hole, because there's other ways to fill the hole, especially with, shall we say, creative or aggressive prosecutors. But they, you know, we definitely were told there's a gap there.
Talking to Kerry Spivak, he's a journalist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the alleged suspect in the planned shooting at a Milwaukee Masonic Center and what kind of charges could be filed against him, not probably including terrorism charges. You also talked to people, Kerry, about the possibility of conspiracy charges, because this sounds like he was conspiring to commit homicide, in effect. That doesn't seem like it's necessarily on the table, though, is it?
No, because he was conspiring with FBI informants, and then who are working at the behest of the agency. So you cannot charge conspiracy in those types of, in that type of situation.
So if he had plotted with someone else who wasn't an informant, then a conspiracy takes more than one, I guess.
Yeah, it takes more than one, and it cannot be with an agent of the government, with the law enforcement, you know, working on behest of the government.
And another reason that the current terrorism laws don't apply, you write, is that he declared himself to be not affiliated with known terrorist organizations. He said, this is not for ISIS, this is not for Al-Qaeda or anything like that. That could have set him up potentially for terror charges?
Right, and therein lies the gap that we were talking about, the lone wolves. That's where the gap is in dealing with the lone wolves. If he had been hooked up with a foreign terrorist group, then it's a much simpler case for the prosecutors to bring a terrorism charge.
And then hate crimes would be another possibility here, but Masons, they're a fraternal organization. They're not viewed as a target of hate crimes generally.
Right, as we quoted a former prosecutor who hates the Masons. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it's not a protected class. Now, if he was confused and he thought the Masons were somebody else, then there could be a potential charge. They would have to prove it. That would be difficult because now you're jumping into a guy's head and saying, here's what he thought.
So as you said, the charges he does face, will face, are the charges for possessing the machine guns and the silencer. Not legal for him to possess. What kind of defense would there be? Are people looking at the fact that he got these from informants as a possible line of defense?
Yeah, they could try the entrapment defense, which is often tried and often fails. It's awful early. I mean, he has not even been indicted yet, so his lawyers, which would be the Federal Defender's Office, would first be going through the records and trying to figure things out. But the entrapment is one that does come to mind always in these types of cases.
Well, Kerry, when we saw, and I think when everybody saw these headlines last week, it was pretty shocking, the potential for this kind of attack that he was talking about. Do you feel like, do you get the sense that people in Milwaukee are feeling on edge, on alert because of this potential threat?
No, probably because it didn't happen, because the cops were able to move in there quickly before there was any type of an attack. Again, it's somewhat, I believe it was the closing quote in the story where we quote the professor, who's also a former prosecutor, as saying that the key is in dealing with terrorism, you don't always charge terrorism. You may be charging them for all types of different things. Sometimes the public won't even know. Maybe it's a credit card fraud or something along those lines, but the individual is on a list that they're watching and they just take whatever steps they could to stop them. So you're prosecuting before there's an attack as opposed to afterward.
And what are you hearing from city leaders, from Mayor Barrett and others in Milwaukee in the aftermath of the arrest last week?
There hasn't been a whole lot. It hasn't become a huge political issue. And again, that's probably because they made the arrest before there was any type of an attack. Mm-hmm.
And, Kerry, you mentioned this is still early in the game to start thinking about what the defense would look like. Do you know what the timeline is like on when court appearances, a trial, that sort of thing?
Well, you'd have to figure if they get enough to indict, which I assume they would, the indictment would come within the next week or two, I believe next week. And then you pick it up from there, because so far, the criminal complaint in the federal system, they, and this type of crime, a lot of times you'll do a criminal complaint because you want to get him arrested right now. You want to get him off the street for whatever reason, in this case, because they say he possessed two machine guns. The indictment, which would have more of the meat and gives the prosecutors a little bit more time to dig into it, will come later. Frequently, people are indicted, and there's never the criminal complaint. In this case, they did the criminal complaint in order to make a quick arrest. So figure an indictment in a week or so, and then you start moving your way through the process. And I'm sure, too, there could be talks about cutting some sort of plea deal at some point.
Kerry, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
No sweat. Have a good day.
That's Kerry Spivak with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, giving us the latest on the suspect at the center of an alleged plot to attack a Masonic center in Milwaukee.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As Iowa caucus goers gear up for their evening in the spotlight, a lot of money has been spent to give presidential candidates a leg up. And some candidates, including Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, have had to leave the field in part because their fundraising efforts couldn't keep pace.
The role of money in politics is nothing new, but our next guest says something new and different has been happening over the last two decades. She says a coordinated effort by libertarian and conservative billionaires has created a far-reaching political network and changed the political landscape nationwide and in states like Wisconsin.
Jane Mayer joins us now. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and her new book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Jane, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Well, can you describe the scope of the political network that people like Charles and David Koch and others have set up?
Sure. The book is in part a history, so it tells the story over four decades, really, as they've set this up. But the current situation is a network of about 400 to 500 ultra-rich conservatives who call themselves investors, most of whom are hiding their identities from the American public, who are part of a group that meets twice a year with Charles and David Koch. And they pool their contributions in a kitty, and that kitty is now, it's got a budget for the 2016 election cycle of nearly $900 million. And so what they've got, it's been described in a recent paper from Harvard University as akin to a third party. It's neither Democratic nor Republican party in the sense that it's not made of broad-based members. It's just 400 or so individuals who've got their own party that has a network of front groups and get-out-the-vote groups and a big data operation and other things that national political parties have, only it's just funded by this one small, intense pool of donors.
The Koch brothers aren't the first or only wealthy political donors out there. There's news out this weekend, for example, that George Soros has committed about $8 million in support of Hillary Clinton. What's different about the dark money network you track in your book from donations like that?
Well, again, I think what's important is that, as you say, there have always been wealthy Democrats, wealthy Republicans, at least in our sort of modern political era. What's different here is they're not just giving to the parties, which are broad-based. They're creating their own party that pushes their own interests. So, I would say that the kind of money that Soros is putting in now, which has not been, he hasn't been doing it until recently. He was a big donor in 2004, and I wrote about him then when he was, and then he's kind of pulled back in recent years. But that sort of money, $8 million, again, is extraordinary, and it shows you the problem is a bipartisan problem. There's humongous money being given by a few individuals on both sides, and it creates a distortion in the political system. Inevitably, the office seekers, office holders, and policymakers are sort of magnetically pulled to serving the interests of the people with the money.
I want to give a listen to Charles Koch in an interview last month with NPR's Morning Edition. He was asked why he spent for Republicans and against Democrats.
Well, it's not so much defeating Democrats, it's trying to find candidates who will move us toward policies that will enabled people to innovate and contribute. The single main issue is to have the foundations of a free society intact.
And Jane, you touched on this point briefly. This isn't necessarily a partisan Republican effort. It's an ideological libertarian movement in some ways that, when it can and when it needs to, works via the Republican Party in some ways. Is that right?
I mean, yes, and you listen to that and you think, well, free society, that sounds pretty good. I think there are pretty few Americans who are against a free society. But what is he really talking about? It's a movement that he launched starting in 1976. I've got in my book a paper that he wrote then that hadn't been seen before, where he models a movement he wants to launch on the John Birch Society, which he belonged to, the ultra-right-wing sort of reactionary political group. He wants to copy the secrecy of the John Birch Society, he says, to create a movement that will destroy what he calls the statist paradigm. Well, what does that mean? I mean, it's a big word, but big words. But it, what he's talking about is trying to destroy the structure of sort of the social safety net and many of the reforms that took place in the 20th century. He wants to push back the clock to sort of the time of the robber barons. And so it's a movement that is far to the right of the Republican Party. That's why it's not just a Republican movement. Charles Koch has been to the right of the Republican Party since 1980 when he ran on the Libertarian ticket, or his brother did, and he was the pushing him into the campaign. David Koch ran as vice president on the Libertarian ticket in 1980 against Ronald Reagan because the Koch brothers thought that Reagan was too liberal and that he was a sellout. So as you can see, they've always staked out a position far to the right of the Republican Party, and that's where they still are.
Talking to Jane Mayer, author of the new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. The election of Barack Obama in 2008 is a big moment in the story you tell. You actually start with a vignette from after that. How did the Koch brothers and their peers react between then and then that big Republican sweep in 2010?
Well, I thought it was really interesting to learn that at the time that the nation's eyes were all focused on Washington with the inauguration of Obama, and the city of Washington where I live was mobbed with people, and that looked like what the action was, but there was a secret meeting taking place soon afterwards in Palm Springs, California, at a fancy resort, where dozens of the richest businessmen in the country got together in secret, and they had a debate. And the debate was, do we work with this new president who's been elected by the American people, or do we try to nullify the election and basically block everything he's trying to do? And they had two sides debating, and they voted to go unanimously with nullify and obstruct. And at that point, Obama and his family had barely moved into the White House. Kind of the die was cast for what was going to be coming next. And I think that the Obama administration was slow to catch on. They were very idealistic and hoped that they could create some kind of consensus in the country. But you've got this group of super wealthy obstructionists that set out to destroy the administration almost the minute it took office, and the story that unfolds in the book of what they did.
I mentioned the year 2010, a big national Republican sweep. I want to bring this home to Wisconsin, too, because that was a big year here. Scott Walker becomes governor, succeeding an outgoing Democrat. State legislature flips to Republican control, a U.S. Senate seat, two congressional seats, Democrat to Republican. How important was the dark money network you write about for us here in Wisconsin?
Well, as I think you all probably know as well as I do, the dark money played a big role in Scott Walker's election, and specifically the Koch network was very helpful to Walker. They had given him a platform early on when he was not yet a statewide figure. Americans for Prosperity has used Wisconsin as one of its anchor states and has really played a large role there for quite some time. It's the part of the impetus in the Koch network and their interest in Wisconsin is twofold. One
they have a long history of fighting organized labor. And so, and of course, Wisconsin has a long history of organized labor. So that's it's a battleground for their ideology. And then Koch Industries has a significant business presence in your state. So it's got something like 3,000 workers and two Georgia Pacific paper plants, I think, and quite a few other interests in the state. So they have a big footprint in Wisconsin, and they put a lot of money in behind Walker, and they boosted him by giving him a platform, and they poured money into the Republican Governors Association, which there's been a lot of good work done showing how that was used as to kind of like a shuffle money around in ways that people couldn't really see, and to evade the state's limits on campaign contributions. It was a very tricky gameplay, and I think they played a big role, as did, of course, the Bradley Foundation, which I also write about in my book, Dark Money.
And that was my next question. The Bradley Foundation is one of the stronger ties to this network you're writing about, based in Wisconsin. How do they fit in?
Well, so the book, what I wanted to figure out was not just about the Kochs, though they are super important and influential players right now, but they're not the only ones. And they've really built on top of a legacy of several other families, some of whom are still involved, but who all followed the same playbook, which was to take these family fortunes, create private family foundations, and basically weaponized philanthropy as a political weapon. They poured their private contributions into these foundations, which then funded the rise of a movement. And so the Bradleys were key to that. And the two brothers that started the Allen Bradley Company were Lynde and Harry Bradley. And they lived quite some time ago, and they died quite some time ago. But what actually happened was their foundation was taken over by movement conservatives who were, some of them, quite brilliant and strategic and thinking what you could do with a private foundation if you turned it into a political weapon.
We're talking to Jane Mayer, author of the book Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, looking at a network of donors led by the Koch brothers and others who have reshaped the political landscape.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your thoughts. What do you think about the political role of the Koch brothers, the Bradley Foundation, and other conservative or libertarian donors? Are you worried about their impact on politics, or are you glad they're supporting their cause? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Jane Mayer. She's the author of the book Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Koch brothers and their political allies are damaging American politics, or are you glad they're fighting a good fight? What do you think about the role of money in politics? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Sarah is on the line in Lake Zurich. Sarah, hi.
Hi, thank you very much. I would like to ask your guest to comment on how the Koch brothers are on the boards of a lot of, I don't know how to characterize it, but institutions and organizations such as PBS, and are they on the NPR board, and museums, and I don't know what all, but how they can try to influence public debate or information that gets out to the public by being on these boards. And you know, like the Koch brothers documentary was pulled. And then apparently one of the Koch brothers resigned from the board of the Museum of Natural History after people complained that he shouldn't be on there because he had anti-global warming opinions. And is that really why he resigned?
Sarah, thanks for that call. Jane, is this part of the story you follow?
It is. There are, of course, two brothers that we think of as the Koch brothers, and the brother who's on most of these boards is David Koch, who's the richest resident of Manhattan, and he is particularly involved in all kinds of philanthropy, and the caller's right. He resigned very recently from the board of the Museum of Natural History after there was a petition drive to get him off the board, mostly by scientists, because David Koch and Charles Koch have been among the largest funders of the denial of global warming science, and people in the scientific
realm were offended that David Koch would have this position in such an esteemed scientific institution. David Koch's also been involved on the board of a couple of the public television stations, and as the caller said, he resigned from the board of WNET, which is the public TV station in New York City, after a documentary aired that questioned his generosity. It, among other things, interviewed doorman in the building he lives in on Park Avenue, one of the wealthiest buildings in New York City, where the doorman said he was the cheapest guy in the building, and he was incensed and felt that his role, he had been about to give a very, very large gift to the public television station. He took it back. He was mad that his money hadn't, you know, I suppose, influenced the programming more. So, and there was a documentary that was being made about the Kochs that was pulled from public television around that time. And I think there was I wrote the first story about it. And I think internally there was great fear that if PBS went further in attacking the Kochs, there were going to be even bigger problems for them. So it's a complicated dance. Many, many families over the years who've been very wealthy in America, beginning with the Rockefellers, have taken advice from public relations officials who've said the best way to get a better image is to contribute money to things like the arts and to beloved institutions. And it ingratiates them with sort of high society, and that has worked quite well with David Koch, for the most part, in New York City.
Sarah, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Ed in Iowa County. Ed, hi.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One is, and both of them are really aimed at trying to get into the heads of these folks. And are they really idealistic folks, or are they simply mercenary and intending to serve their business interests? Or is it impossible to divide those two objectives? And secondly, this incredible infusion of money is gravely threatening our democracy. And how would those folks answer to that? Are they supportive of the principles of democracy?
Ed, thanks for that call. Let's get to that first point. Are the Koch brothers and the others in this network ideologically motivated, or are they serving their business self-interest?
Well, I think the caller hit it on the head when he asked, or are they the same in this case? And it answers his second question as well. Having spent almost 5 years now writing off and on about the Koch brothers and spent time reading everything they've written and said and everything that's been written about them, I can say that I think they are true believers in what they are saying, but what they are saying is that what's good for Koch Industries is good for America. There's no daylight between their ideology and their self-interest. They believe that if it's good for their bottom line, then they can provide more jobs and they can do great things for America, and that they are better providers for the country's well-being than the U.S. government is. That is truly what they believe. And so when it comes to whether it's good for them to pour all this money into the American democratic system, they would say sure, because it's pushing the country in their direction, and they think their direction is the country that's in the country's interest. Their self-interest and the country's interest are completely fused as far as they're concerned. So there's almost no difference. And you know, that in itself is a peculiarity of them. And many other people obviously have taken issue with this, because Koch Industries, while it has provided something like 60,000 or 70,000 jobs and makes some products that we, you know, many Americans use every day, everything from Vanity Fair napkins to Dixie cups to Stainmaster carpet to Lycra, all those things that people rely on all the time, it also has a history of just egregious pollution, all kinds of illegal problems with workplace safety, and all kinds of problems with pollution. They're the largest producer of toxic waste in the country. They are one of only three companies that ranks in the top 30 for all three kinds of pollution, that is air, water, and climate pollution, according to a recent study, and that's using the EPA statistics. And they push their interests very heavily in Congress. They have a gigantic lobbying operation. So, they see this as good for everybody. Others may disagree.
Ed, thanks a lot for that call. Jane, looking ahead, where do you see this this network playing out in the 2016 presidential race and congressional elections, for that matter?
Well, they've got this jackpot that they've accumulated, a campaign war chest of nearly $900 million. Now, that's twice what the Republican National Committee spent in 2012, which again shows you that it's akin to a national political party that they are privately funding, they and the other investors in their group. And they're planning to play a very, very big role. Charles Koch's now 80 years old, and I think he sees that the horizon isn't going to be, you know, open forever for him. So he's really playing for keeps here. And even in the 5 years that I've covered them, they have stepped up their role in national politics so significantly, and they've also been flushed out of the shadows significantly. So they've moved from being funders of kind of right-wing philanthropy and libertarian think tanks and things like that to really operationalizing their movement to an on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground movement that goes door-to-door, that pushes in state legislatures, even in some local races, in school board races. They've, you know, opposed things like funding for a zoo in Columbus, Ohio. They've gotten involved in all kinds of issues. Many states, they've opposed the expansion of Medicaid. And so they're playing on many levels in this country in a way that I think probably makes them different from what we've seen before. It's not the ordinary politics of Democrats versus Republicans.
Thanks to Jane Mayer. Her new book is called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. A major milestone in the book world. Today is the 20th anniversary of the publication of Infinite Jest, the mammoth novel by the late David Foster Wallace.
Wallace appeared on WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge back in 1996 when that book first came out. And here's a little bit of what he had to say about the sheer heft of Infinite Jest.
This is a very long and fairly difficult book that I also wanted not to be a standard kind of avant-garde book, most of which right now I admire as a writer, but just aren't very much fun to read. So I wanted it to be both long and difficult, but also to be fun enough, you know, so the reader wouldn't throw it at the wall on page 100.
Wallace is a huge name. It's a huge book. I'll admit, I've only read a book of his essays, actually, that you loaned me a while back. I have not read Infinite Jest. It's one of those big books that's out there that maybe I should read, but I haven't mustered up the courage quite yet.
Right. True Confessions of a Public Radio Producer and David Foster Wallace lover. I love his
stuff.
You're a big fan. And I haven't read Infinite Jest. I've sampled it extensively, but I have not read it. I'm not afraid of big books, though. What about
sometimes,
you?
Sometimes they're daunting, and sometimes I'm ready. War and Peace. Like, one time I'm like, okay, it's been sitting there for years, I'm going to read it.
I was also defeated by War and Peace.
Okay.
Too much war, not enough peace.
A Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth. We're both big fans of that one.
That we both read.
So we want to hear from you. Is there a big book that you read and we're glad you did, or one that's sitting on your shelf that you're waiting to have the time to read? Let us know over at the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.